The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the May 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, the Exploration issue. And we'll begin with an article titled, The Man Who Saved Havana, by Tony Perrotet. In a sweltering morning in old Havana, a courtly figure in a crisp gray Guaybera shirt weaves through the Plaza de Armas, the city's Spanish colonial heart, trying not to attract attention. Although none of the foreigners lolling beneath the banyan trees and royal palms recognize him, a ripple of excitement passes through the Cubans, who nudge each other, smile, and stare. Perhaps only on this island obsessed with its operatic past could a historian become a celebrity on par with a Clooney or DiCaprio. Eusebio Leal is the official historian of the city of Havana, a regal-sounding position that brings with its enormous influence and exposure. He starred for many years in his own TV show, where he explored old Havana's streets, and he is as far from the cliché of the dusty, isolated academic as it's possible to get. In fact, Leal is credited with almost single-handedly bringing old Havana from the brink of ruin to its current status as the most ravishing and vibrant architectural enclave in the Western Hemisphere. Deftly dodging well-wishers, Leal ducks into the historical library, where some 50 female workers line up to kiss him on the cheek and offer flustered greetings. In his hectic round of duties, he has come to honor one of Cuba's countless obscure intellectual champions, a certain Alfredo Zayas Mendez, who founded this archive 80 years ago, an exalted act in a nation with the highest level of education in Latin America. Standing before a plaque, Leal orates off the cuff for 45 minutes about the bibliohero Zayas, a rhetorical tour de force that includes fond personal anecdotes, philosophical musings on the importance of memory, and flirtatious exchanges that make the audience collapse into helpless laughter. He then takes questions, poses for snapshots, examines a restoration plan for the Havana capital, offering his expert opinion about work on the dome, before dashing off with his minder to a high-level government meeting. The whirlwind visit leaves everyone a little dazed. At age 75, Leal shows no signs of slowing his notoriously hectic pace. For the last 50 years, almost as long as the Cuban Revolution has lasted, his outsized personality has been inseparable from old Havana itself. Working within the communist system, he pioneered a capitalist network that would save the district's architectural heritage at the same time as maintaining its community life, so that it would not become a living museum like Venice or Old San Juan. A consummate politician, he combined a deft personal touch with the poorest residents while navigating the high corridors of government and hobnobbing with Fidel Castro. Although he has stepped back from direct power in the last couple of years following a serious illness, he is still regularly loaded with international honors, as both Cubans and foreigners, even Miami exiles, fall over themselves to pile him with praise. Eusebio Leal is a legendary figure in the preservation world, says Joshua David, president of the World Monuments Fund in New York, who visited Havana for a workshop on architectural restoration in February 2017. He pioneered innovative ways to fund restoration in old Havana, which at the same time supported social programs like health clinics and old age homes. He's an incredibly complex, brilliant man, declares Gregory Banowski, a left-wing Canadian lawyer who has worked in Havana since 1995 and has dealt with Leal in his office of the historian, OHC, regularly. He's the best of the revolution. Leal's own workers are intensely loyal. He inspires everyone, says Mariela Moulet, the chief of the Prado Investment Group working on the Capitol. He saved old Havana through his own willpower. There won't be another one like him in a long time. On the street, the support is even more effusive. Leal is the only person who Cubans would erect a monument to while he is still alive, declares Elaine Alera, a young librero or bookseller. When I was a boy, I was there when he personally came and presented my father with his bookselling license. Without Leal, Havana would be nothing like what it is today, sums up the American historian Nancy Stout, who worked with his office on several books. A lot of Cubans would do anything for him. Today, Old Havana still protrudes into Havana Harbor like a clenched fist, surrounded on three sides by glistening blue waters, and a stroll through its streets provides a unique glimpse of the first European steps in the New World. The city was founded in 1519, when the Spanish still had one foot in the Middle Ages, and captains would casually write in their ship's logs about sea serpents, dragons, and men with two heads. Like Christopher Columbus, who made landfall in Cuba on his first voyage 27 years later, settlers grappled to understand what they saw. They imagined the tracks of crocodiles were those of enchanted lions, and groups of distant cranes were monks in robes. The Taino Indians carried mysterious firebrands of flaming leaves they inhaled and called tobacco. With its deep harbor and strategic location, Havana soon became the staging post for brutal missions of discovery. Conquistadors sailed forth in search of El Dorado and the Fountain of Youth, and the wonders they did find, like Cuzco in Peru and Tenochtitlan in Mexico, proved more extraordinary than fantasies. Soon galleons loaded with Aztec and Inca treasure gathered in Havana beneath a string of honeystone fortresses built to protect against pirates like Sir Francis Drake. Twice a year, armadas of up to 30 boats loaded with gold and silver and their heavy naval escorts would catch the Gulf Stream back to Seville on the Carrera de Indias, the Indies route. The same current brought the marlin that would lure fishermen like Ernest Hemingway centuries later, the fish traveling like cars along a highway, as he put it in Esquire magazine. The story of Leal's meteoric career rise began in the same spot Havana was founded nearly five centuries ago, the Plaza de Armas. Dazzled by its intricate facades, a gorgeous brocade of carved curlicues, heavy oak portals, and wrought iron balconies, few visitors notice that the northern flank of the plaza, known as the Calle Tacon, is paved with smooth wooden bricks. It was here that a confrontation unfolded with the municipal government that would, in a sense, define Leal's future. In 1967, as a self-taught 25-year-old historian in revolutionary Havana, Leal learned that a heavy truck had cracked open the asphalt in front of the governor's palace on the plaza. Investigating the site, he found fragments of a colonial-era wooden street, which the German naturalist Alexander von Humboldt reported seeing in 1800. It was laid, legend holds, so a governor's wife could enjoy her siesta untroubled by carriage wheels rattling on cobblestones. Apart from a few fragments in Paris, Rome, and St. Petersburg, the wooden bricks were a unique find, and Leal soon gained permission to repave the entire stretch in wood. But as soon as he was about to start, news arrived that a cultural delegation from Europe was on its way and the government workers were rushing in with asphalt instead. I realized I would lose the opportunity to create something unique and beautiful, he recalls. So he lay down in front of the steamrollers, a rare act of civil disobedience in Cuba. The standoff lasted until the mayor of Havana himself came to beg Leal to get out of the way, promising that he would be permitted to re-excavate the street later. He kept his word and so did I, recalls Leal with satisfaction. And the whole world celebrated the discovery of something fantastical and different, the wooden street. He then reworks an old Cuban rhyme, Hay que poner un poco de locura a veces en la cordura. You sometimes need to inject a little madness into the sanity. In other words, he explains, if you are too sane, things don't proceed. Nothing happens. I had managed to find Leal in a rare moment of calm by meeting him at, of all places, the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, where he had traveled to give a lecture. Trailed by his entourage of embassy officials and aides, we wandered the Catholic college's verdant grounds to visit Gothic chapels and candle-filled shrines, while he painted a picture of Old Havana as vividly as if we were in the Plaza del San Francisco. Today, Leal is frail and thin, but he's still a master orator, speaking in perfectly formed sentences like a Spanish intellectual from another age. Perhaps because of his illness, he was unusually willing to speak about his early life, which had offered few clues to his success. Despite his rebellious streak, Eusebio Leal Spengler was in many ways a quintessential product of the Revolution. He was born to a poor family in the shabby, low-rise Cayo Hueso district of central Havana, a typically Cuban immigrant mix of Spaniards on the father's sides and Alsatians on his mother's, who traveled to Havana via Charleston, South Carolina. Although he grew up only a few hundred yards from Old Havana, he never visited until he was age 7 or 8, he says, when an elderly friend of the family took him to her home. I was amazed, he recalls. I'd never seen stairways go up to that height. The magnificence of the cathedrals, the colors, the crowds of vendors selling everything in the street, the way they sang and danced, it was really a fascinating world. He kept going back as a teenager to explore. When I could see it closer, with more maturity, I was astonished by the carved stones, the spectacular iron latticework, the enormous doors, he recalls. It all impressed me greatly. At the time, Old Havana was regarded by government planners as an embarrassing eyesore. As crowded as Manhattan's Lower East Side in its heyday, it was avoided by wealthier Cubans as a vice-ridden slum. In 1955, the dictator Fulgencio Batista even approved a plan by a New York design-based firm to level the colonial enclave's core. Catering to Cubans' passion for American cars, it was slated to become a combination parking lot and highway interchange lined with cheesy boutiques for cruise liners. Luckily, the plans never got past blueprints. The Cuban Revolution intervened. Leo was 16 when Batista, having made millions from bribes from mafia-run casinos, fled into exile on New Year's Day 1959. A devout Catholic, Leo rushed to the church bells to usher in the new era as throngs of habaneros took to the street. In jubilation, we were celebrating the end of the massacre, Leo recalls, the time when corpses would be found every day in the street when people disappeared. A week later, Castro and his barbudos, the bearded ones, rode in on their victory caravan. The revolution paralyzed the systematic destruction of buildings, Leal explains. But Fidel proved to be more interested in Cuba's impoverished countryside than the capital, which he regarded as a parasite filled with American gangsters and prostitutes that had sucked the country dry. Old Havana was saved from the wrecking ball but left to poetically decay. In 1959, Fidel guaranteed the district's social coherence by banning evictions and reducing rents by 30% to 50%. Contrary to Marxist dogma, citizens who stayed in Cuba were allowed to keep one home and one holiday residence, according to Banowski. Still, the revolution transformed Leal's life. He had been forced to leave school in the sixth grade to help support his single mother, who worked as a washerwoman and a cleaner. Now that education was free, he put himself back in school and began to lap up the deluge of art, music, and film, Italian realism, Ingmar Bergman, Orson Welles. Above all, the voracious autodidact haunted the libraries. It was in the silence of the library that I learned the love of books as objects and their fascinating contents, he says, poring over works of the ancient Roman engineer Vitruvius and the Renaissance architect Palladio. I am what I read in those books. He also sought out the very famous office of the historian. By ancient tradition, every old city in Latin America maintains the institution of chronicler, who is named for life to save the memory of the city, he explains. In the early 1960s, the position was taken by a writer with the sonorous name of Amelia Roig de Lauschenstring, and Leo went to study at the small museum he maintained. In 1962, after charming Roig's wife and secretary, he was introduced to the man himself. They spoke for hours. He was very eloquent, very accessible, Leo recalls. When I was leaving, he took both my hands like a salutation and said, "This is not an end, it's just the beginning." The prolific Roig was at the center of a circle of left-leaning bohemians. There were historians, teachers, geographers, Leo recalls, of this golden age. I was 20 years old. There were mostly 60, 65. Some were 80 or more. I used to track them down in their homes. He laughs, rapping the table with his knuckles as if knocking on a door. By the time Roig died in 1964, Leo was a regular at the historian's office. I wasn't an employee, but a confidant. 3 years later, when a plan was unveiled to turn the governor's palace on the Plaza de Armas into the first museum of Havana's history, Leo was hired as architect, archaeologist, and at times, laborer. It was very manual. I was sometimes a construction worker, sometimes a bricklayer. At the same time, he worked alongside renowned scholars such as Irving Rouse of Yale University. When the museum finally opened in 1976, Leo was the natural choice to be its first director. By then, his work had drawn the attention of Celia Sanchez, Fidel's partner in the guerrilla war of the 1950s, who took a passionate interest in Cuban history. Celia had become the unofficial gatekeeper for access to Fidel, and her patronage allowed him to present his ideas to the maximum leader. Leo went to Celia to lay out his personal vision, says historian Nancy Stout, author of the biography of Sanchez. She would talk to Fidel and create a momentum that people couldn't oppose. It was a valuable friendship. Leal's Catholicism and energy had ruffled the feathers of many communist bureaucrats. When you're riding a horse, you kick up lots of dust, and those who follow behind get dust in their eyes, and it bothers them, he says. Celia helped and protected me. International recognition came when Old Havana and its crown of Spanish forts was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1982, among the first sites to receive the accolade. The listing covered 529 acres, including 242 blocks with some 4,000 buildings. Not all of them are colonial. In fact, Old Havana's streets are a sprawling encyclopedia of Western architecture, with buildings from the 16th to the 20th centuries tossed together, a mix of Rococo, Baroque, and neoclassical styles, with crumbling gems such as Art Nouveau pharmacies thrown in. But the UNESCO honor came with few funds from Geneva, and foreign tourism was not considered a way to attract income. Tourism was still regarded as part of a very exploitative past, says Joseph Scarpacci, director of the Center for the Study of Cuban Culture and Economy, and co-author of Havana, Two Faces of Antillean Metropolis, referring to the mafia-run casinos and brothels that had defined Havana in the 1950s as the Sin City of the Caribbean. Fidel had always made it clear that he didn't want Cuba to be an island of chambermaids and bartenders. By the end of the 1980s, Old Havana was in a dire state. Its 75,000 residents were often working without plumbing or regular electricity. Landmark buildings were on the verge of collapse and riddled with amateur renovations. Pools of putrid water and garbage gathered in the corners. The sidewalks were cracked like eggshells, and there was almost no street lighting. Old Havana, it was sometimes said, was a 40-watt town on a good night. Salvation came, paradoxically, from economic disaster. The collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of sugar subsidies in 1991 threw Cuba into bankruptcy, beginning a decade of privation, euphemistically called the special period in time of peace. Things were desperate by 1993 when Leal accompanied Fidel on a trip to Cartagena, another Spanish port in the Caribbean that the Colombian government was turning into a hugely lucrative tourist attraction. On the flight out, Fidel came to Leal's seat, he recalls. He asked me, "What can I do, or what can we do for Habana Vieja?" Without hesitation, Leal explained that an entirely new economic model was needed where hotels, restaurants, and museums would earn hard currency. The U.S. dollar had just been legalized, and profits could be pumped directly back into restoration. The approach departed from decades of state-controlled policy, but Leal told Fidel that without a sound financial basis, the idea of saving Old Havana is a utopia. It's a fantasy. It's like St. Augustine's City of God. Saving Old Havana did not mean giving up progressive socialist principles, Leal assured Fidel. In fact, central to his plan was to keep residents in their homes and use tourism to improve living standards. We're not talking about Pompeii or Herculaneum. We're talking about Havana. We have to invest in schools, playgrounds, services for the elderly. Leal drew on liberation theology, he says, which inspires progressive priests to work in poor communities from rural Brazil to Nicaragua. It's not possible in Latin America to talk about social justice without taking into account Christian thought. Fidel was sold. A trained lawyer, he personally drew up legislation to create a unique company called Habaganom, which could deal directly with foreign investors and would exempt from returning its profits to the state. Though the name sounds like a Soviet-era pharmaceutical venture, Habaganom was actually a heroic Taino Indian leader of the early 1500s, who quite probably gave his name to Havana as well. Leo was at last appointed historian of the city, given $1 million in seed money and carte blanche on how to use it. Fidel gave him everything, says Stout. He even had a special security force at the historical sites. Cubans used to joke that he had his own personal army. Fidel's sense of urgency may have been heightened by an incident in Old Havana only a few weeks before. A visiting British journalist for the Independent newspaper was photographing the splendid facade of the College of the Holy Angel in Plaza Vieja when it started to wobble in front of his eyes. He said to me, "Oh, look, it's falling down," in typically dry British style, recalls Victor Marin, an architect and vice president of ICOMOS, the International Council of Monuments and Sites in Cuba, who was with him at the time. "And as we watched, the whole thing crumbled before our eyes." Although nobody was hurt, photos of the collapse were plastered around the world, embarrassing the Cuban government, which seemed incapable of looking after its heritage. Leal's first adventures in the 1990s were modest. With his team of academics and craftsmen, He opened for paying guests three small restaurants in the Hotel Ambos Mundos, where Ernest Hemingway had lived in the 1930s while writing For Whom the Bell Tolls. It was conveniently located between La Floridita, a bar known for its excellent daiquiris, and La Bodega Gita del Medio, famed for its mojitos. Thanks to the U.S. trade embargo, workers had to be creative in finding building materials. I was able to talk to Fidel almost daily about the problems, and he would come up with a solution, Leal recalls. He became Fidel's man for capitalism, managing the only for-profit entity in all of Cuba. Funds from his first humble enterprises were soon put back into restoring more restaurants, bars, and hotels, as well as the colonial squares. In Plaza Vieja, an ugly parking lot from the 1950s, which was in theory underground but actually rose a yard above the ground, was imploded, and its centerpiece became a fountain of Carrara marble with spouting dolphins, recreated from old drawings of the original design by Giorgio Massari, one of the myriad Italian artisans who flooded Cuba in the 18th century. Residences were also renovated. Behind the Fototeca de Cuba gallery on the Plaza Vieja, for example, is a Spanish courtyard with eight apartments that are still inhabited by the original residents. Their housing was built from scratch in vacant lots. At the same time, a percentage of the profits went to programs such as breakfast for school children, maternal care facilities, centers for retirees, and spaces for young artists. All this made Leal immensely popular, a beacon of hope in the grim economic horizon of the special period. Leal got things done, says historian Stout, but he was also there for habaneros in a very intimate, hands-on way. He would go to the construction sites every day to make sure his workers had lunch. As success followed success, the office of the historian expanded. In 2003, it took over much of the seaside promenade, or Malecón, and in 2005, Chinatown, while Old Havana became the engine for Cuba's booming tourist industry. The financial benefit from Vidal's original million-dollar investment is hard to estimate, since Cuban companies do not open their books. But in 2011, the Washington Post reported the annual revenue of Habagano was $119 million, with $23 million in profits. The Office of the Historian employed some 3,000 workers, most of whom were locals, and by 2016 it managed some 20 boutique hotels, 25 restaurants, 30 stores, various museums, a radio station, and a glossy magazine, Opus Habana, a total of over 300 different entities. As Cubans joke, when we want to be, Cubans can be more capitalist than the capitalists. Leal, meanwhile, became a uniquely Cuban celebrity, a deputy in the National Assembly, known for a series of marriages to much younger women, which Fidel and Raul Castro attended, and a popular media star. For his hit TV and radio series, Andar La Habana, Walk Havana, he wandered the streets recounting forgotten stories. How, for example, the British captured the city in 1762, then exchanged it for the Spanish city colony of Florida. He also became a darling of the foreign media, even in the United States, where National Geographic described him as a man of action as well as words, the academic answer to Che Guevara. He was handsome. He was well-spoken, recalls Lucy Scott, then a field producer for CBS News, who interviewed Leal several times. He knew his stuff, but he was also very off the moment. Only later do we realize the real depth of his knowledge. Leal was chosen to give personal tours to visiting dignitaries. Most recently, he showed Pope Francis around in 2015 and President Barack Obama in 2016. Eventually, Habagano became a victim of its own success. Though Leal was above suspicion, corruption scandals began to emerge in the company after 2012. The details are still shadowy. Cuba is like a Fellini film. You never know what part of the journey you are in, says Carpacci. But there were a string of arrests for embezzlement, drug sales, and bribery. Leal became seriously ill, and while he was recovering in August 2016, control of Habagano was transferred to a sprawling military-run enterprise called GAESA, G-A-E-S-A. Leal declared that the move would allow the historian's office to concentrate on its true mission, cultural preservation. And so far, GAESA's presence has little practical effect. They said they would keep up support for our projects, and they've kept their word, says Aileen Robenas, an architect and urban planner with the Master Plan Office, which oversees the preservation efforts. Old Havana's status is now assured at the center place of Cuban tourism industry. It's one of the most extraordinary historical centers in the world. says Joshua David of WMF. And it's even more remarkable for its proximity to the United States. You can fly a few minutes from Miami, and you're in a completely different world. Today, the handoff of the historian's office is everywhere. In the Old City. Its logo on interpretive signs, before and after photos, entitled Para no Olvidar, lest we forget, and building sites. The master plan is now a shiny high-tech Warren filled with engineers, architects, and sociologists offering Wi-Fi to local residents and a hall for monthly meetings. One of its popular events is a weekly seminar on how to start small businesses. The office receives 50 applications a week from budding entrepreneurs, mostly for paladares, private restaurants, and casa particulares, bed and breakfasts, it says. Visitors from around the world now throng the cobbled pedestrian lanes between the four plazas, dubbed the Golden Kilometer by the office. Leal's former headquarters in the Plaza de Armas, the Palacio de los Capitanes Generales, is now surely one of the world's most charming museums, with emerald peacocks parading around its courtyard filled with palm trees. Next door, the Palacio del Segundo Cabo, built in 1772 as the Royal Post Office for all of Spain's Latin American possessions, was reborn in May 2017 as a state-of-the-art museum devoted to cultural connections between Cuba and Europe. From there, a parade of columns, as Marin dubs the shady colonial patios, leads to the cathedral, as the Cuban author Alejo Carpenter calls music turned to stone. And we'll have to stop in that article today. We'll pick up with that article on next week's program, because we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.